I wonder if somebody can get them the word being if they went to their office. They're in the building.
Yeah. So, good morning, everybody. We're going to call the meeting of the LCPFP together, and I'm hoping that our staff team could round up the senators who, or the members who went back to their offices thinking we were going to delay a little while. I know I saw Senator Senjum in the hallway, and if we could let him know if he's not listening. And pardon me? Senator Newman. It would be fantastic that they know that we're getting started. And because we have a full agenda, and because we have a couple of our members over talking with the governor, I thought it would be a good idea to at least get us started. So we don't spend too much time waiting. And so I'm going to move to item 4 on the agenda, which is the sequestration and the impact of that on Minnesota's economy. And we have Margaret Kelly and Bill Marks and Eric Nauman here to testify and to share some information with us. So we'll hear from them and take questions, and we'll move our way through the agenda. Are there any questions? Thank you for joining us today. Welcome to the committee.
Margaret Kelly, Minnesota Management Budget. And we're just going to tag team here, the three of us as we go. I'm going to start by just refreshing everyone on the sequester that it occurred in March of this year, about $85 billion in federal cuts, and about half of that coming from defense and about half of it coming from non-defense. There were many at the federal level, mandatory program and discretionary programs that were exempt. For example, Medicaid, one of the biggest federal dollars coming to the state budget. Across the board cuts in federal fiscal year 13 was about 5.1%. And then there's a different process for budget cuts in federal fiscal year 14 and beyond. It's not the same across the board cuts as in fiscal year 13. And then finally, final 2013 appropriation levels and agency flexibility for implementing sequester cuts has either been mitigated or worsened the effects of sequester on specific grant programs. So there was the sequester, there was a federal budget adopted, and that affected how the sequester was implemented in many agencies. This is just information from, I think it was October when we were here last, the Minnesota state budget and how federal funds flow into our budget. Approximately 30% of the fiscal 14-15 budget is from federal funds, and this is based on the February forecast. About $9.7 billion, 4.9 of that, most of it is coming from Medicaid, which was exempt from the sequester. And about 10% of the state's full-time equivalents are federally funded. And this slide just simply shows you which agencies, where those federal dollars flow. Again, most of it coming to the Medicaid program. So this information is right out of our February forecast, how we were anticipating at that time that the sequester would impact Minnesota's economy. And our analysis at that time was that the sequester would not be the same in all states, and it would depend on how federal funds flow to different states, and that would impact each state's economy differently. And MMB's economists believe that Minnesota would be among the states that would see only modest shocks to the economy because the level of federal funding that comes to Minnesota is relatively small compared to other states. And that the sequester cuts at the federal level for defense and non-defense spending would reduce Minnesota employment growth by no more than 5,000 jobs. That was our assumption in the February forecast. So the reason that we were saying that federal sequester cuts would have a modest impact on Minnesota's economy is that we have a relatively low exposure to federal funds compared to other states. We ranked 47th among states in total federal expenditures as a percent of the state GDP, and this is based on 2009 data. And based on 2011 data, Minnesota ranks 49th in federal per capita spending. The graph here, if you can see that, you can see the light blue is Minnesota compared to the dark blue, which is the national numbers. Direct payments are the types of payments that go directly into someone's bank account, so Social Security payments, Medicare payments. And we have a younger population than the national average. Grants is dollars that go directly to state agencies or to schools or to local units of government or to nonprofits. And included in this number is Medicaid. And even with federal grants to Minnesota organizations and governmental units, we are below the national average. Procurement would be the purchases that occur, mostly military purchases, and we are well below the national average there. And salaries is the federal workforce in Minnesota, and again, we're below the national average there. I'm going to turn it over to Bill and Eric to speak in more detail to how those funds compare.
Madam Chair, members, you have in your packets, you have something that looks like this. It's a Federal Funds Information Service publication called State Policy Reports. And it's where the last couple graphs of that Ms. Kelly had came from. We've included a total document here. We just point out that this is federal fiscal year 2010 data, and FFIS tells us that may be the latest or the last data that's available in this kind of format. It's data that the Census Bureau puts out, but the Census Bureau has stopped putting it out. It's part of their budget cuts, apparently. So this data is a couple years old. Just want to point out a couple things in this material. If you look at page 3 in that publication, that's the state share of federal spending by category. And Minnesota, about in the middle of the page there, if you look in the first column, Minnesota's population is 1.7% of the U.S. population. And then if you follow the columns over, total federal spending is Minnesota gets 1.4%. And then there's the breakout for the various categories. In the discussion in here, and actually on the previous page, the point would be if Minnesota has 1.7% of the population, the goal would probably be having 1.7% of the federal funds. Minnesota does not achieve that level. And just for discussion's sake, it points out that South Dakota is a good example of a state with an average performance. And if you look at South Dakota, you can see that they have 0.3% of the U.S. population, and they get 0.3% of total federal spending. And if you follow the categories over there, right at 0.3% in each area except procurement, which is 0.2%, but it's pretty close to a state that has 0.3% of the population and getting 0.3% of the federal spending across all the categories. Then I also wanted to point out on page 4 of the publication is the data that Margaret had in the chart that shows on per capita federal spending for fiscal 2010, shows that Minnesota ranked 49th at $8,367 per person or per resident of the state. We've added a couple other charts that are on individual pieces of paper in your folders. And it pulls out the Minnesota data for total federal spending. The first one, thank you, would pull out the total federal data for Minnesota federal spending at the 8367 level in 49th, and then also breaks it out for the individual categories that we had talked about. I have Medicaid listed separately on here, but it is part of the state and local grants number that is above that. And so you can see the individual numbers there. And then on the second handout, which is now up on the screen, we're showing Minnesota federal spending in Minnesota and neighboring states, Iowa, North and South Dakota, and Wisconsin, and then the U.S. average just for each of the categories. So for your reference, if you want to compare Minnesota and neighboring states, that information's there. The state policy reports provides a little more background information in all of these different categories, and you can look through that information and use it as you wish, but the background data is there and the individual data for each of these. So this is just kind of a summary of that particular publication. So. And Madam Chair, I think that's pretty much what we have.
Let's keep it short and sweet.
So thank you, Mr. Mark.
I think that's the summary.
Members, are there questions on that rich but quick explanation? All right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So if we can, I'd like to continue on the agenda. And first up would be information on Head Start. And I'd invite Gail Kelly and Deborah Moses up. Welcome to the committee. I know you know the drill, but if you could identify yourself for the record.
Great.
And begin. Have a moment for technical assistance.
Just turn the screen on. Yeah.
If you don't mind my hands on the screen.
Don't mind your hands.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, my name is Gail Kelly. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Head Start Association. I live in Duluth. The Minnesota Head Start Association represents 33 Head Start grantees, including 7 tribal and 1 migrant grantee. These organizations write federal and state grants to deliver Head Start and early Head Start services in communities across Minnesota. Head Start delivers comprehensive services to pregnant women and families with children under the age of 5 who live at or below the federal poverty level. And I think it's important that we note that there is no other federal program that has a lower income eligibility than Head Start. Neither Minnesota, MA, WIC, all have higher income eligibility. And this last year, income eligibility for Head Start was around $23,500 for a family of 4. So Head Start's priority is to always serve the highest risk families, and these are children who need more than preschool to be ready for school. And we provide that by providing comprehensive service to families, not just educational services, but health, nutrition, social services, family supports, whatever families need to get their children ready for school. And I also want to mention that you can't visit a Head Start program without seeing families there. Head Start has staff who are parents. They're on their governing boards. They make decisions every day on the day-to-day operations. So this sequestration has really impacted families as they make the very hard decisions to make budget cuts. So I want you to be aware that they worked with the Head Start families to make these choices. Finally, I do think it's really important if you haven't visited a Head Start program recently that maybe you have an opportunity to do that, because all the research in early childhood has really come to bear in terms of innovative approaches and new strategies to help get kids ready for school. So I invite anyone to visit. So in 2012, Minnesota Head Start programs leveraged $102 million in federal grant funds and $20 million in state funds. So on March 1st, when the federal government asked us to reduce our enrollment and address sequestration, it was a blow, to say the least. We were told that we would be reducing around 700 children, that we would have a total cut of 5.27%, which comes to about $5 million out of the $102 million that comes to Minnesota. And I'm here today that we have a pretty good understanding now about the impact of sequestration on Minnesota Head Start. And it translates to hundreds of children losing slots, teachers and staff losing jobs, classroom reductions, and a reduction in the overall infrastructure for early childhood, some reductions in hours and days of service, and an economic impact on local businesses who depend on us as service. We depend on them for services. I think maybe in the Star and Tribune yesterday you saw that the Federal Office of Head Start released their state totals for children cut due to sequestration, and Minnesota actually had a higher cut than we estimated when we talked to the legislature in March. 988 fewer children will be served this school year than in the past. So we are looking at about 16,500 compared to 17,500 last year. To put this in perspective, it's the largest cut to Head Start programming and infrastructure ever. We've never seen this sort of cut in the history of the program. And it just so happens that it happens at a time when the governor and the legislature has made a and our president has made a substantial commitment to early childhood. To get an understanding of where these cuts were made, Head Start programming is very labor-intensive. 75% of our funds are for salaries. So reports from local programs indicated that we lost over 100 jobs, good jobs, with benefits. And we almost all employees experienced some layoffs and some furloughs. Our real costs are in classrooms. Our classrooms compose of 20 kids with three teachers and home visitors who have caseloads of 10 to 12. So to make any cuts at all, we had to be able to cut that sort of infrastructure. We estimate we reduced the size of Minnesota's early learning infrastructure by 40 classrooms. So I just want to make it clear that we decided to make smart cuts. We wanted any child who got into a Head Start program to get the full dose, the full experience, so that we could make sure they could get ready for school. So that required that infrastructure be shrunk. And so fewer kids who are English language learners, the highest risk kids who depend on our services, will be getting services. But unlike other states, we did not cut as dramatically days and hours of service. So the federal estimates were around 4,200 service days cut for Minnesota, whereas most states reported tens of thousands of service hours and days cut. Finally, I just want to say that local businesses will also feel the sting of sequestration because upwards of 25% of our budgets go right back into buying gas, food, and offering services in local communities. And some of our programs are considered to be major provider, contributors to the local economy. So every dollar that came out of Head Start comes out of the local economy. I've asked Deb Moses from the Community Action Partnership of Ramsey and Washington County, who experienced one of the larger cuts, to talk a little bit about how this has impacted them. And then after that, we can take questions if you have any.
Welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Deborah Moses, and I am the Head Start Director for Community Action of Ramsey and Washington County. Our Head Start covers all of Ramsey County. I live right here in this great city of St. Paul. I'm a conscientious public servant, and working for Head Start has always allowed me to do that. I know daily that the services we provide truly make a difference for some of our most vulnerable population, which is young children living in poverty. I know this because of the educational outcomes we document through authentic observations using evidence-based assessments, as well as our strong documented outcomes in ensuring that the comprehensive needs of the children we serve are met prior to entering kindergarten. Throughout the school year, I already receive phone calls daily from distraught parents wanting to know why their children cannot get into Head Start. 3 weeks prior to this school year opening for us, we already have a waiting list of approximately 300 children with our classrooms full. This waiting list will grow exponentially on the first day of school when families realize the school year has started and they have not yet enrolled their 3 to 5-year-olds in Head Start. During the school year, our average waiting list is from 700 to 900 children. We expect this to grow much higher with the cuts we took due to sequestration, which led to lost opportunities for 150 children just in Ramsey County alone. Approximately 70% of the children we serve do not speak English as their home language. This is identical to the population of St. Paul schools currently. And because of our high percentage of English language learners, we as an organization were reluctant to participate in the statewide study of Head Start outcomes, feeling that our children might be at a disadvantage and might be unfairly judged. This concern became stronger when we found out that, in fact, the children we serve, given their learning English, came into our program at a lower school readiness than statewide, even other Head Start programs. What we found out, however, with our great staff and the comprehensive services and what we provide, that by the end of the year, our children gained at a higher rate to completely equal out to children throughout the state in a spring assessment of their abilities and their school readiness. We're told constantly by St. Paul School staff that they always know which children attended Head Start due to their high performance in the classroom, as well as their parent involvement. Our early Head Start program provides home visiting services for children 0 to 3 years old. This program, in addition to comprehensive early childhood services, provides an essential link between the home and Head Start. Many parents of young children are reluctant to trust early childhood programs with their children, but through the relationship we form in home visiting, we're able to lessen some of the concerns of trust. Through our home visiting program, we also often have contact with other community members, and we find that by word of mouth, residents of a building are often waiting for our staff to translate everything from utility bills to health information they've received in the mail, and they know that we're going to be there and that we're going to help. However, we have a roadblock in the next step, and that is getting those families' children into our Head Start program because of our long waiting lists, which, again, are growing longer. While I could tell you stories for hours about the great successes we witness daily, such as a recent 2-year-old child from Burma speaking Korean, who no one knew couldn't see farther than an inch until our nurse came in and provided an assessment screening, vision screening, and eventually we were able to give that child glasses. The videotape watching that child take their first steps as a sighted individual is something that would bring tears to anyone's eyes and is something that doesn't show up on all of our measurement tools and our assessments and our evidence-based practice, but shows truly the great strides we make and the difference we make in people's lives. I'd like to end with the 5 what I believe to be the most important points. That is, as I said, in Ramsey County alone, we have lost Head Start opportunities for 150 children due to sequestration. Head Start children enter kindergarten with all screens completed in the child's home language, ensuring accuracy of the information. Families leave Head Start prepared for the K-12 experience. I think so. Children who enter Head Start at the beginning of the school year not speaking English, except for those with documented learning disabilities, leave Head Start at the end of the school year speaking English. And finally, most importantly, Head Start children do enter kindergarten ready, and we have the outcome data to back that up.
Thank you. Go ahead. Thank you. Any questions from members? Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And earlier in your presentation, you talked about 4,200 service days lost. Could you define what a service day is and how that's measured?
The way the federal government did it was to count up all the hours and days of services that were reported by all the programs across the state as being cut from their calendar, and then divided by the total number of children that were remaining to be served. So that's where they came up with the 4,266.
And Representative Holbert.
I'm sorry, thank you. When you say remaining to be served, is that including on your waiting lists? And
no, just those that are enrolled, that would be enrolled.
Okay, I'm still not totally clear.
Yeah, it was a confusing number for me, too, but they basically wanted to show that in addition to the cuts of actual children who wouldn't get service, that there were days, especially for our programs that had to make cuts last year, they had to cut days of service and like cut the last 2 weeks of class or the first 2 weeks of class. So they added up all of the hours into a matter of days and then figured that out in terms of how many hours and days would be lost for kids being served.
And if I might, Mr. Chair, so this would be for children that were enrolled, and it would be measured against the program statewide.
Right.
Is that correct?
Okay. Right.
Thank you.
Can I, Mr. Chair and members, one thing that gets confusing is that Head Start receives their allocation from the federal government on a different monthly basis. And so some of us found out, for us, we're an April 1 grantee, so we found out in March, while our program was still operating, that we had to cut a substantial amount of money out of our budget for that school year, so we had to close early. Other grantees don't receive their money until later, and some received it earlier and had even a greater impact.
All right, thank you.
Senator Sheba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kelly, I assume that the, I think I recall that the early childhood scholarships that the became law this last legislative session don't take effect until next year. And so if the sequestration cuts continue for Head Start, how do you foresee those scholarships helping to supplement your programming?
Ms. Kelly.
Our understanding is funds will be available in October.
Right.
Actually, on Friday is the deadline for applications for the one pathway of scholarships, which is a pathway with programs that have waiting lists. And I am anticipating that many of our Head Start programs will be applying for pathway two for scholarships. I do want you to understand, though, that that cost of a Head Start slot is $7,600. And there's a $5,000 cap on scholarships. So in order to be able to bring a new child into the program, we have to find an additional $2,500, $2,600 to leverage with that scholarship. And our funds are pretty well already set in terms of the kids that we're currently serving. In areas where there are a large number of scholarships available, Head Start programs are going to try to leverage those to add new classrooms. But at this point, we don't know what that impact will be in terms of taking children off our waiting list with scholarships. And I will tell you that we did, I think, make it very clear that the $5,000 cap was a challenge for Head Start. We certainly expect to see enhancements with the scholarships for kids who need more to get ready for school. And I expect that that will be another a way that people use scholarships.
Other questions? Representative or Senator Newman.
It's still, Mr. Chairman, yeah. I don't. Hard habit to break. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Kelly, given the fact that we're dealing with cuts to federal funds, mm-hmm. and we obviously are here with the state of Minnesota,
yeah.
Are you here with any kind of specific requests for this committee or the legislature in general with respect to these federal cuts?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. We did come to the legislature in March when we realized the cut and asked for the support of the legislature in terms of mitigating some of those cuts, and that legislation wasn't successful. So we did bring that to the attention. As you know, we have a $20 million funding stream through the state legislature for additional Head Start slots. So we asked if that was a possibility. At that point, that was not successful legislation. I'm not sure that we're going to come again to the state legislature this session. We are trying our best to make scholarships work for Head Start, and we will be advocating to reconsider the cap on the scholarships. But I do want you to be aware that that these are Minnesota kids who are not getting services, and the kids that need it the most. As we said, these are kids who need to learn English, They need to learn social skills. They need their mental health addressed. And so I guess this is a partnership where I ask you, what should we be doing? I also know that we are putting a lot of pressure on Congress. There have been over 7,000 articles about Head Start, the impact of sequestration. So we're making it very clear to our congressional members that children are at risk here.
So where do these kids go if they don't get into Head Start? Do you have any information on folks that don't make it, what other programs they could end up in or what the quality of those are, et cetera?
Mr. Chair, our responsibility is to refer our waiting list off to other people. With the scholarships, our hope is that some of our school partners are starting to do more early childhood. Obviously, if a child has special needs, we're going to be referring to early childhood special education and making sure that those children get into the necessary services. We're going to be trying to leverage the scholarships to, figure out ways with our partners to make more opportunities available. We really believe in our approach. Mm-hmm. So we would like to see more expansion of Head Start.
Representative Lopp.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Kelly. I mean, I just think this is really a tough time for our kids. We've stepped up as a state to say we realize the value of early childhood education. I know that just in Hennepin County alone, we'll probably grow to about 5,000 people on the basic sliding fee childcare waiting list, and you add more people on your waiting list. And even though we've helped a little bit with the scholarships, with the limitations of those programs, it's just going to make such a small dent. And so at a time when we've really committed to seeing the cost effectiveness of this in terms of addressing kids' ability to get ready for school so they don't need later remedial education, I can just say that the places you're referring people to are growing leaps and bounds as well. The economy hasn't totally recovered for a lot of families who are working and struggling with child care costs and trying to find quality placements.
Mr. Chair, I just can concur with the comments, and just to let you know, our partners are equally stressed to be able to make the appropriate referrals for families, particularly those families that need ELL services and need special needs and mental health supports.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Also, I can tell you that in St. Paul already, in St. Paul School District, the pre-K program is already full, as are we.
So I think we're going to thank you very much for coming today. We really appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, can I just?
Yeah, Senator Senjum.
I mean, the problem is the problem. So my question and even the answer is not going to help a lot, but I just wanted to get a sense of the scope. I read this, for instance, and in round numbers, it says that about 988 or 1,000 less kids will be served this year in Minnesota. And just above that, it talks about 17,005. So realistically, we'll be serving around 16,500 kids, and that's per the data here. But I'm a little confused with 300 on a waiting list for St. Paul and Ramsey County, and I'm not sure on Hennepin County, maybe even Olmsted County has probably got a bunch. What really is the extent of the
need
of the need,
Mr. Chair?
I mean, if the need was met, would it be doing 20,000 kids or?
It's a very good question. We know that there's 64,000 children under the age of 5 in poverty in Minnesota, so we are talking about making a dent in that coverage of all kids in poverty. But last year, we came to the legislature and told them in April we had a waiting list of 6,200. I think that, on an average year, our waiting lists run statewide around 5,000 to 6,000 children. I think if we were able to serve that additional amount of kids, we would be making a good stride toward better coverage for our riskiest kids. But, again, we have not been able to find the current scholarships are $4,000 for all kids, all the way up to income of $185,000. So we haven't had that kind of concentrated expansion for a long time.
Mr. Chair, not to belabor it, but just will the scholarships, will the $5,000 capped scholarships, carve away at some of those?
Ms. Kelly.
Some of that number?
I hate to speculate, but at this point, calling all the programs in the state, I only know of around five programs that are going to be able to leverage additional children with that money because they have some other funds to be able to match with the caps. I'm speculating around 100 to 200 kids that maybe we can pull off the waiting list. The rest of the kids will get enhancements.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Chairwoman Visner. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Irma Visner, and I am the tribal chairwoman of the Great Whiters Nation of Ojibwe Indians, located in northwestern Minnesota. Our reservation, our tribe of 20,000 members, is the largest in the state. We also are economically the poorest tribe in the state. In 2009, residents on the White Earth Reservation with income below poverty level were 79.7% compared to 14.6% in the state. So close to 80% of our people on the reservation at White Earth have income below poverty level. Since 2009, our overall economy has not improved. It's only gotten worse. In 2012, the White Earth Tribal Council did an assessment of need. In order to meet the minimum standards of living on our reservation, the unmet need for housing, health care, public safety, human services, education, transportation, and overall infrastructure was close to $400 million. The impact of sequestration is devastating to White Earth. As the Tribal Council and I work through the FY14 tribal government budget effective October 1st, we will be making 5% cuts across the board in all services and programs. In FY15, we will prepare for 9% cuts for our overall budget. This means less funds, more human need, and greater challenges. Now, I am to focus on education, but I also included other areas of need. Speaking of health care, the U.S. Indian Health Service is the primary health care provider at White Earth. It's funded at 43% of need. The number one health problem on the White Earth Reservation is mental depression, followed by disproportionately higher rates of sugar diabetes, high blood pressure, cancer, and substance abuse. We do not have the resources or facilities to meet the demands of our health problems. 3 weeks ago, I gave the opening remarks at the Tribal Health Symposium on the Grand Portage Reservation. The symposium was sponsored by the Minnesota Department of Health. Commissioner Ed Ellinger was present. I said we tribes have an epidemic of drug abuse on our reservations that is harming and damaging the most vulnerable and innocent of all, the newborn babies who are born addicted to drugs. At Essentia Health Hospital in Detroit Lakes, these primarily speaking of the White Earth Reservation now as it applies, 13 Indian babies were born addicted to drugs the past April. 14 Indian babies born addicted to drugs in May. At Bemidji Hospital that primarily serves White Earth, Leech Lake, and Red Lake reservations, 80% of Indian babies are born addicted to drugs. During the drug withdrawals, twitching, jerking, labored breathing, these newborns require intensive care in the Fargo and Minneapolis hospitals. Some newborns have damaged hands due to clenching their fists during withdrawals. I ask Commissioner Ellinger and his department to help. Think of the challenges and resources these babies will have when they go to school and the workforce later in life. 2 years ago, the White Earth Tribal Council issued a declaration of a public health emergency with respect to illegal drug use. We called upon state and federal agencies to partner with us to combat drugs that was and is continuing to destroy our families, communities, and tribe. The Tribal Council and I heard from our communities. The Tribal Council adopted a civil commitment code. Today, there are 39 court-ordered commitment cases, but no place or facility to send them. No, we do not need nor want sequestration or budget cuts. We need intervention, resources, and facilities now. In the area of education, the dropout rate for American Indian students is the highest in the state for any minority group. Approximately 60% of American Indian students drop out before reaching high school graduation. On the White Earth Reservation today, 50% of the adults age 18 years and older do not have a high school diploma. This year, FY13, the White Earth Adult Basic Education Program, ABE, received $36,778 from the state of Minnesota and $2,594 from the federal government. The White Earth Tribal government contributed $142,080 for a total budget of approximately $180,000 for adult basic education. The White Earth Adult Basic Education Program graduates more Indian students with their high school diploma than area high schools. In May, 37 students received their general equivalency diploma at White Earth. In FY14, a 5% cut of $9,072 will decrease classroom size, materials, and transportation for the White Earth Adult Basic Education Program. In FY15, a 9% cut of $16,331 will further diminish and decimate the program. Sequestration will eliminate $60 million in federal impact aid at the federal level, adversely affecting the Pine Point School, Circle of Life Academy, Natawash Community Charter School, and surrounding school districts that serve Indian children from the White Earth Reservation. Pine Point School, grade K through 8, is both federally and state funded. The school does not have the ability to bond, levy, or borrow. In FY13, with general education aid from the state, the Pine Point School based its budget on 45% funds from federal impact aid, a $95,000 decrease from the previous year. Education is my high priority as the tribal chairwoman. Education was my ticket out of poverty. I grew up in a large family, 8 of 8 children, 1 passed away. Grew up in the harshest, harshest poverty. Who would ever imagine a 16-year-old high school dropout who the public school system gave up years back? Go back to school, graduate from college with honors, and ultimately have the opportunity to go to Harvard to earn a doctorate, all because I was given a chance. A chance to graduate from high school, a chance to be admitted into college, and a chance for financial aid. It was a chance of a lifetime of choices and not circumstances. Today, less than 5% of American Indians can afford college without assistance. So I ask for your help as we struggle with budget cuts in education. I want to speak just a minute about housing. Housing on the White Earth Reservation, homelessness is a persistent problem, and it's growing. Today, approximately Approximately 400 families at White Earth need adequate housing. The families are doubled and tripled and quadrupled, living with relatives or pitching tents in yards. One household on the reservation has 26 people living in the home, elders, adults, and children. The White Earth Housing Program will be cut by at least $2 million due to sequestration this coming year. An elder told me, quote, if our people had a decent home and a good job, a lot of social problems would go away, unquote. There's a good amount of truth to the elder's words. In public safety, recently Governor Dayton came to the White Earth Reservation to sign his executive order on government-to-government relations and consultation with tribal nations of Minnesota. I described to the governor the financial challenges to maintain our White Earth Public Safety Department. The tribe provides a majority of the law enforcement on the White Earth Reservation, which is a large square area of 36 miles on each side. White Earth Reservation is a public law 280 state jurisdiction tribe. The tribe receives minimal aid from the state for law enforcement, and I asked Governor Dayton to help us get the financial assistance from the state as the counties receive for law enforcement. And I now ask for law enforcement funds from the state legislature. And I say this because we have so many issues within our communities that it takes a multi-pronged approach: health, education, public safety, human services. We all have to work in a collaborative manner. So I thank you very much, Miigwech. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Any questions, members? So what's the kind of total scope in terms of the impacts?
Sequestration is devastating to our tribe. Approximately 54% of our overall tribal budget are federal funds. And our Indian health programs this year are cut 2%. So when needs are so great and further budget cuts come, I don't know what the future is. It's pretty bleak. We are preparing. A reporter asked me, what do you plan to do? Well, we have to prepare for the worst and hope for the best. I was up in Washington, and Senator Klobuchar says, I'm trying to get rid of that sequestration. Well, Senator, I pray you do.
Other questions, members? So presumably the impact radiates out from the reservation to surrounding communities as well. And the Manoman County in particular, I suppose, in terms of the impact on their resources?
The impact is already, as I listened to Head Start, we have already closed, the Head Start testimony, we have already closed one center. We've had to. Yes, it's Mr. Chairman, it's devastating to tribes. Yeah. The large rural area tribes. Manoman County is located within the exterior boundaries of the jurisdictional boundaries of the White Earth Indian Reservation. Manoman County, according to the 2010 census, is the poorest county in the state. So,
Go
ahead.
I was just going to say we appreciate it. And I was at Red Lake on Monday, and they were conveying many of the similar concerns about the impact of sequestration on their members as well.
As chairman and members of this committee, I thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to share.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have a quick question. You know, some of us have been talking about this for over a year and asking questions of our agencies as, you know, how are you preparing for this? I believe the Department of Health, and I'm sure Representative Murphy can correct me if I'm wrong, or the speaker, but I think like 40% of their budget was federal funding. What kind of help are you getting from the state agencies in either preparing opportunities to backfill federal funding or innovations in how they're delivering their services to try and compensate for some of these lost federal funds?
Chair Visner.
Thank you, Chairman. It's difficult. It's difficult when needs are great, have been great for a long time, or historically. It's difficult. And to some extent, we don't know what, we don't know how long the sequestration will go. All I can say is White Earth is a great partner. White Earth is a great collaborator, you know, collaborator with state agencies, with state government, with federal agencies, because White Earth believes that when we pool our resources together, we can do greater things and better things. So we are working with everyone we can.
Mr. Chair, if I might, for follow-up, we enacted one of the largest increases in spending in the last legislative session. Are there any new programs that are being implemented by the state that would help with some of these issues that you're excited about that might help?
One, thank you. Thank you so much. One of the most transformational, I would say transformational initiatives between state government and an Indian tribe has been the transfer of human services from this, from the counties to the tribe. And we had legislation changed or drafted and have passed 2 years ago, and so all these programs are transferring to the tribe for several reasons: cost efficiency, better services, less duplication, and we estimate over 2 years, the biennium, it will save the state of Minnesota like $6 million. And who is in a better position to serve our people than our tribal government? So that's one very, very good initiative. The other one is our tribe. We have a tribal college on the White Earth Reservation. And the tribal college, as well as other colleges, are severely underfunded. I met with Director of Higher Education, Larry Pogemiller. This year, each of the tribal colleges are eligible for $150,000 because we also educate non-Indian students, provide services to non-Indians. That's good. So.
All right, thank you.
Representative Carlson, was that the hand I saw?
Yeah. Mr. Speaker, I have a follow-up to your question when you asked about the impact on the surrounding communities. The number of Native Americans that live in our large urban centers, if you could comment on what some of the needs are there, and to give you a feel where I'm coming at it from, a while back I met with a group of Native American parents from the Robbinsdale School District, and one of the points that they made was that they wanted me to be aware that there were significant number, although a low percentage of the student population that lived in the Robbinsdale schools. And they felt most of the programs overlooked the needs of their children because a percentage of the students, I'm talking now mainly education, a but as a percentage of the students in the district, they were overlooked because they didn't meet the percentage thresholds, but yet it's a district with about 15, 16,000 students. There were a significant number of students in need. And if you could comment on any of that, if that fits into, you know, your work in northern Minnesota at all.
Your visit.
Thank you very much. But you're asking me, I'm sorry, I'm trying to follow what...
Well, Mr. Chairman, the needs of Native American students, the parents made the point that the needs of Native American students in our large urban school district, county suburbs, it's a suburb, are often overlooked because under so many of the rules, they don't meet the percentage of students in the school district that qualify them for federal funds, maybe even some state funds, I don't know. And yet, because these are large school districts, there are a significant number of students numerically.
Right.
And their point was they're being overlooked, and I just thought maybe you would have some information on that, what needs to be done in terms of meeting some of their needs, because I do know that one of the people I've met with was an enrolled member of the White Earth Tribe, but living in the Twin Cities.
Chair Visner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I fully understand the issue that you are raising and the concern of the parents. We, as American Indians in the state of Minnesota, comprise 2% of the population. All of us, 11 tribes. A majority of American Indians live in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. More of our tribal members at White Earth live here than on the reservation. However, many are moving home because of the welfare to work requirements. I just want to take show an example of what you're saying, of what you're expressing. In 2008, Governor Pawlenty held a after-school summit. And as I sat there in that summit, and this wasn't the governor's fault or anybody's fault, but as I sat there, I heard nothing really on the data and statistics about American Indian youth. Nothing. National statistician there, wonderful people at the summit. And so I rose up and I spoke and I asked why. Because the American Indian population is statistically insignificant. And what was not statistically insignificant was that the Commissioner of Corrections had met with our tribal council just a few months prior and informed us that up to 47%, 46% of the youth in the juvenile correctional system are American Indians, and yet we were so disproportionately represented in our children in the juvenile correctional system when we comprise 2% of the population. That's the problem. And thank goodness we're working for more accurate data and statistics for American Indians.
Thank you. Thank you for coming today, too. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. May I leave this?
Yes.
Whatever I...
With Kate, I think. Does that work, Kate?
As a part of the record.
That's terrific. And we'll get that distributed to everybody.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Kerr, yes. Thank you for coming. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Don Kerr, and I'm the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs. Accompanying me today is Lieutenant Colonel John Lovell, and we're going to provide you some information with regard to the recent impact of furloughs on our federal technician workforce and the Minnesota National Guard as a result of the sequester. As you probably know, a significant portion of our full-time workforce was affected by the sequester manifested in furloughs that were mandated by the Department of Defense. We have now completed our 6 days of furlough. We took those 1 day a week for the affected employees for the last 6 weeks, and this is the final week, and most of our employees have completed their furlough days. With that, I think I'll turn it over to Lieutenant Colonel Lovell for more details with regard to that impact.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lieutenant Colonel John Lovell, Director of Human Resources for the Minnesota National Guard. For some facts, reference to the furlough in the Minnesota National Guard and how it impacted us. The Minnesota National Guard is comprised of around 13,000 Army and Air members, and of that, approximately 20% of that force is full-time. That full-time force is predominantly made up of two different types of full-time employees. One is the Active Guard Reserve, or AGR program, very similar to active duty, and the other one is the Federal Technician Program. In the Minnesota National Guard, just over 10% then of our full-time employees, more than our AGR, is the technician force. That equals 1,166 technicians, Army and Air. The direct impact of the Army is 733, and each of the wings, 133rd here in the Metro at 202, and the 148th at 231 in Duluth. That comprises a total budget or annual budget for our technician force is $93 million, just over $93 million. The impact to the individuals was over the course of those 6 weeks a 20% reduction in their paychecks. Common question asked by most people is, what does the majority of that force that wasn't working, what do they do? Predominantly, that makes up our maintenance individuals and our personnel services individuals. So these are the full-time people that keep all the equipment running for our traditional forces to use on their weekend activities. And also they manage all of their personnel records, promotions, and such. Another question commonly asked is, what was the total savings then from the Minnesota National Guard? And we calculated that to be just over $1.3 million of those 6 furlough days. And that's a savings to the federal government. As Mr. Kerr already indicated, this was our last week of directed furloughs. How that looked to the Army was every Monday for 6 weeks, those federal technicians were not in the office. We directed that to have the least amount of impact to the other agencies that would be interacting with each other. And if everybody was gone on the same day, that would be on Mondays. And for the air wings, it was either a combination of Monday and or Friday based on the needs to keep flight operations moving. That is most of the information that I have other than specific to the timeline of events and how that came out. But with the current reduction from 11, we were originally planning for 22 days, and we had a reduction to 14, and then a reduction to 11, and then most recently down to 6 days. So any questions, members, for the testifiers? So and what into the future do you anticipate?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question. Unfortunately, we feel that the future is looks a lot like what we just experienced. The Secretary of Defense did indicate that for FY14, furloughs are still on the table and could be possible. Again, that would be, if it were to be a furlough, the maximum amount of days is 22. So there is absolute possibility that we will be planning for this again in the next FY.
And is that an FY that starts in October?
That is correct, okay, sir.
So the 22 to the 6, what was that about?
The 22 days?
Yeah.
The maximum we're allowed to conduct a furlough for individuals is 22 days. Anything over 22 days, it would actually have to trigger a reduction in force.
Okay. And you were able to just allocate that in a different way across the force more broadly, is that?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Chair, at the national level, because of some modifications that the Congress made in June, it allowed funding flexibility for the department to move money around the various accounts they normally didn't have the authority to do, that they were able to find enough money to reduce the number of technician furlough days down to six for this fiscal year. Moving forward, we don't, of course, there is no federal budget for FY14 yet. We're 40 days out. We don't anticipate having one. We expect to once again be operating under a continuing resolution for a period of time. And, of course, we will not be able to forecast until that continuing resolution is resolved and they pass a budget what the impact will be. We have an expectation that if there will be a furlough, it will be similar to this year, that it will be deferred to the back part of the fiscal year, just based on the way that the Congress has done that business in the past. We also know there could be congressional action that could limit the department's ability to impose a furlough. We don't know what the outcome of that will be, of course. That's all speculative. And what we would like to point out
does
is...
Does that mean that you'd have to find the savings in some other way then?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's exactly correct. They would have to find the savings in some other way, I believe. Of course, it depends how the law would be written.
Sure.
We would like to point out that so far, the sequestration has not impacted National Guard training days in any way. All of the statutory inactive duty training, along with the annual training days that are statutory, were conducted or available to our service members. And in fact, we did expect a reduction in schools funding, which is normally above that line. We, in June, received a plus-up in our schools funding that allowed some of our soldiers to attend school in addition to their annual training. We did, however, see a pullback in the sophistication of our training. So there was one particular training exercise that was scheduled for the 34th Division to conduct with the Pacific Command in Australia. That exercise was scaled back to about half of its original size and conducted instead from Fort Lewis, Washington, to reduce costs. So I believe what we're going to see moving forward will be continuing to train at about the level we expected, though there will be fewer opportunities to do a very highly sophisticated level of training. Of course, that's speculative until we have the budget and know how the Secretary of Defense and the Secretaries of the Army and Air Force choose to execute the guidance. I will tell you this, at this time it is the Adjutant General's intent to not ask for any supplemental funding. And in most cases, funding that would be reduced on the federal side, supplementing that funding with state dollars would actually be a violation of federal fiscal law. So we do not anticipate coming back to the legislature and asking for supplemental funding to make well any lack in federal funding that we have from the Department of Military Affairs.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Just for clarification, are the furloughs occurring in armories across Minnesota? Is it generally kind of widespread, so to speak?
Mr. Chair?
Sure, go ahead.
Sir, very good question. It is actually occurring throughout the state. However, in the more highly concentrated areas, you see a greater impact. So, for example, the 148th Fire Wing in Duluth, they're all in one location. You're seeing a greater impact to their organization and probably to the community than you would say there are smaller armories out in the smaller towns.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I guess if I may, one comment. Colonel Lovell did mention $1 million in savings to the federal government. That is, of course, $1 million directly that did not go into the economy of Minnesota. That's $1 million that was born on the backs of our service members, and we're disappointed in that, but we understand that that's what we're required to do.
Right. And so those families for the last 6 weeks have been getting 80% of what they usually live on, essentially.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much. We really appreciate you coming and helping us out with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Ms. Wood? Welcome. Oh, go ahead.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the commission, and thank you for taking the time to learn about what is happening with the Older Americans Act. My name is Jean Wood, and I am the executive director of the Minnesota Board on Aging. The Minnesota Board on Aging is a 25-member governor-appointed board. It is administratively placed at the Department of Human Services, and so as a part of my position with the Department of Human Services, I act as their executive director. The Minnesota Board on Aging has several roles in government, and I will be going into those, but this is a snapshot, and I know you have copies of this PowerPoint also, but this is a snapshot of what the Minnesota Aging Network does, and this is the network that is funded through the Older Americans Act. It annually supports over 215,000 older Minnesotans and their caregivers. They operate through seven area agencies on aging. They use about 100 contracted service providers and over 330,000 volunteer hours as they deliver services. So many of the services that they delivered do involve the use of volunteers. Down at the bottom, you'll see a line of numbers and some brief descriptions. And the second and the third box are the ones that describe the number of individuals that are served by congregate meals and home-delivered meals. And my understanding is that that is an area of concentration that you want to look at today. I'm joined here today by Steve Pekarski from Lutheran Social Service, who will be talking a little bit more about nutrition on the ground, as they are one of our the area agency contractors. Minnesota is aging. Minnesota is aging, and it's a fact. For most of our lives, we were used to the population over the age of 65 increasing 1 to 2% a year. It has started to accelerate, and that we know by 2030 the number of individuals in Minnesota over the age of 65 will double. And we know the same thing will happen in another 10 years, 20 years of people over the age of 85. But that is the environment that we live and operate in. Under the Older Americans Act, we target the services funded under the Act to those in the greatest social and economic need. The law says that we are to serve people over the age of 60, but we are to target those services. And they probably say about 35 times in the law that it's to those with the greatest social and economic need, with particular attention to low-income minorities, those who do not speak English as a first language, and those residing in rural areas. And so what we do is we serve people who are limited means, who are not eligible yet for elderly waiver or alternative care. We target it to people in high risk of falling into the public safety net and the use of high-cost services. And thus, we are a way of preventing people from needing medical assistance and being more of a burden to public pay. And so that's how we target these services. The Older Americans Act, as we administer it, there are really three main roles for the area agencies on aging. And they are long-term care options counseling, better known as the Senior Linkage Line, or MinnesotaHelp.info, which is the website that we use for services, and health insurance counseling in a variety of areas that are of interest to older individuals where they need information, timely information, along with their families. The area agencies who work with us also do service and systems development. Every 2 years, the Department of Human Services does a gaps analysis to find what are the gaps in services and are able to start a conversation with communities about If you have gaps in services that impact older individuals, are there ways that we can help those communities build those services? And we have a variety of tools. And then the area agencies also administer the service funding, and you can see that it is about $40 million annually that comes into this system. Roughly half of that is in federal dollars, mostly Older Americans Act. $3.6 million is in state funds. $2.3 million of that $3.6 goes to nutrition. This legislature has provided those funding, that funding for nutrition since 1976. And then about $17 million it comes from local match. The Older Americans Act is a matching funding source, meaning that local service providers have to match it at the rate of anywhere from 15% to 25% with local funds. So about $17.3 million come in as local match or as local contributions, frequently donations from people who use the services. The Area Agencies on Aging, who administer this funding through contracts with local providers, also have local advisory boards that provide direction regarding the best ways to meet local needs and to adjust to the changing demographics. We distribute the funding through a funding formula, which is based on regional demographics. It is distributed to us by from the federal government based on state demographics. So we distribute all of the funding through a funding formula that goes to the Assistant Secretary on Aging and has to be approved by him or her. Oops. Sorry. I'm obviously not good at flipping papers here. I apologize. So the impact of sequestration on the Older Americans Act has been not so heavy in 2013. Area agencies, because of the timing of how the sequestration happened and because there was some funding left over from previous years in reserves, were able to maintain funding levels in 2013 and be able to take time to make adjustments for 2014 and beyond. But starting in 2014, we will start seeing some significant impacts to the programs funded by the Older Americans Act. On the next slide, we have here the percentage impacts of how each fund was automatically cut. And I've highlighted nutrition because we received two pots of funding from the federal government for that. And you can see the percentages that were cut. These first two under senior nutrition, congregate meals, home-delivered meals, are intended for those programs. And then this third program, which is an incentive program, is USDA money that also comes in. It comes in through a federal allocation process. It was also cut.
Do we know how many people that is?
We do know how many meals that is, and it will be about 130,000 meals is what the impact will be. And we have put that together as a part of a national coalition that's trying to work on ending the sequestration for the Older Americans Act. And so we have reported those numbers in several venues.
And how many meals does a typical person get during the course of the week, or is that hard to say?
That is hard to say. We really don't have any typical people. I mean, we will serve up to five meals in a week. Some of them will come as frozen meals in a home delivered. Some are home delivered every day. At a congregate site where you might have individuals who are a little bit more mobile, sometimes they will come honestly, once a month. Sometimes they will come 3 and 4 times a week.
So that, I mean, so we're talking at least, if everybody got 5 meals, that would be over 20,000 Minnesotans that are going to be losing access to this.
Yeah, two a meal.
And then it's unlikely that everybody's getting 5 meals, so it's probably more than that then.
Yeah, okay. I mean, that could be a back-of-the-envelope calculation. Indeed.
All right. So that's the nutrition piece, that first bullet point.
That, okay. Yeah, that's the nutrition, and because Lutheran Social Services is here to discuss that, I wanted to lay a larger background, because it's really not nutrition services in a vacuum. You know, it is, if they are able to go to a meal site, it could be a question of transportation, which is what we also fund under our supportive services line item in the Older Americans Act. If they need a home-delivered meal, they may need heavy chore. They may need transportation to the doctor. And, again, we would fund those under the Older Americans Act. These people are not yet eligible for elderly waiver or alternative care. Their average age is 78. Half of them are living alone. So we have been working with the area agencies on aging since the sequestration became known to us, and we have some tools that we are using to analyze the participant data so we can understand who is using our services and where. And again, our intention is to apply and use as one of the have the area agencies use as a part of their criteria the targeting criteria that we have in the Act. So through our new reporting tools, we are going to be asking questions like, are we providing enough service to those who need it? Are we providing too much? Are we targeting services to those most in need? If not, if we do have a meal site where people are generally coming once a month, is that a meal site that may need to be thought in terms of if there's going to be less money? Maybe that's the meal site that needs to be closed. Efficiencies. Are our programs operating in an efficient manner? And let me just say, we operate these programs side by side with elderly waiver and alternative care, and so we have the same contractor generally around the state for all of those meals. And so for a person who's coming to get a meal, it's just a matter of the difference of the funding source. They would all be getting the same meal.
So have any sites closed?
Mr. Chair, we have had, I know of 2 sites that closed this year. But we close sites every year because things shift around the state. We have population shifts. We have a general shift from west to east that's happening to us. You know, there are lots of things that we take into consideration. It really is a fairly dynamic management process.
Sure.
Sorry.
Mr. Fikarski?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Steve Fikarski, and I'm the Associate Vice President of Older Adult Services at Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. LSS provides a wide range of human support to nearly 100,000 people of all ages in each of Minnesota's 87 counties and in more than 300 communities. Today I'm going to focus on our new senior nutrition program, which began at LSS in 1973, shortly after the Older Americans Act authorized congregate nutrition services. The Older Americans Act authorized congregate nutrition services in 1972 and home-delivered nutrition services in 1978, with the purpose of reducing hunger and food insecurity, promoting socialization of older adults, promoting the health and well-being of older individuals, and delaying adverse health conditions through access to nutrition and disease prevention and health promotion. LSS's senior nutrition program has grown to over 200 community locations in 39 counties across the southwest, northwest, and central Minnesota, and many of these are in small rural locations. We provide various options for older adults to receive nutritious, hot, frozen and cold meals ranging from congregate dining sites, home-delivered meals, and diners clubs, which are partners with local restaurants. In 2012, we served approximately 19,000 individuals, and that was approximately 1 million meals, a little bit over 1 million meals. Before I get to the challenge of the federal sequester, I just wanted to share a quick story. There was a lady whose name is Gretchen, and she's from Bemidji.
Yeah.
She ended up in the hospital for malnutrition. She weighed 98 pounds and was having severe psychotic episodes. The hospital kept her until she was stable, and then they moved her to an assisted living. After about a month, she just wasn't happy. She wanted to move back home to the place where she had lived all her life and wanted to be back there with her friends and neighbors. Her doctor agreed he would discharge her from the assisted living if she accepted Meals on Wheels and promised to eat the meal each day that it came. He set up a follow-up visit for a month just to see where things would be at. The next time she went to the doctor a month later, her mental health had stabilized, and she had no psychotic episodes during that month. She even reported that the meals were actually pretty good, and the bread wasn't bad at all because it was homemade. After about 6 months, her weight was back up to 120 pounds, which was her ideal weight, and she has had no more mental health episodes. She's actually going back to teaching piano lessons a few days a week. Home-delivered meals gave her a second chance to live independently back into the community. Though LSS is dedicated to providing nutritious meals to older adults in rural areas where we serve, the reality is the current model and the challenges with funding may not be sustainable due to many factors. Today I will talk about two specific issues that may impact our ability in the future to provide nutritious meals to the many rural older adults across the state. First, the federal sequester that made automatic across-the-board cuts, as Gene referenced, beginning this year, will have a tremendous impact on providers across the state to be able to continue to provide the service. Older Americans Acts were cut as part of the sequester, as Gene had mentioned, and just based upon our informal projections LSS has been provided, we anticipate the 2014 cuts, we will have a minimum of about 15% reduction between 2013 and 2014 over that period of time with our contracts with the local AAAs. And that is due to the sequester and the formula based upon population that Gene referenced. Due to the funding formula changes described by Gene, in the rural areas of northwest Minnesota, this has already had a significant impact on the services we offer. This year alone, we have closed three nutrition sites, and there's always the potential when you close the site that those folks will go unserved. If there's a 90-year-old person that was receiving Meals on Wheels that is in one of those areas where a site had closed, even one of them having to be placed in institutional care, the cost for this service will greatly outweigh the previous cost of the community-based service. The sequester reduction combined with the flat overall funding due to the population change leaves the most vulnerable older adults increasingly isolated, potentially malnourished, and lacking resources to live independently in their own homes and avoiding nursing home care. As we approach 2014, LSS will most likely have to make the difficult decisions to close additional sites across the state and in many rural locations where we currently are. At this point, we're probably targeting anywhere from 15 to 25 locations across the state, and some of these will be in the smallest population towns in Minnesota. Site closures would potentially impact about 1,600 people that we currently serve and account for about 100,000 meals. And many of those individuals that potentially may go unserved are in the moderate to high-risk nutrition area. Even if nutrition sites do not close, many may have to reduce hours or the available times that meals will be available to individuals. From our experience, when a site does close or have reduced days, the impact on people like Gretchen that I've referenced before is significant because many older adults do not have access to grocery stores or restaurants in their towns or communities. They don't have the transportation to get to neighboring communities to get to those resources. They may not have the strength to cook their own food. All this leads to an increase in isolation, depression, overall decrease in health outcomes. Nutrition is a safety net, and it's a health support as well as a food support. And without the availability of meals provided by agencies like LSS, someone else is going to have to step in. And who is that going to be? For people like Gretchen, this could mean living in more costly nursing home or other institutional care instead of living independently where she's always lived. The second issue is that over the years in many of the small communities we're at, there has just been a transformation in those populations. Some of them have moved from very bustling regional hubs to just more isolated towns. When they become more isolated, this makes the service harder to reach those older adults in those communities that are in most need. According to the state demographer, the share of Minnesotans living in rural areas has been declining, but the population that remains will be increasingly older, and the ratio of older people to younger people will be greater in rural communities by as much as 20 to 35%. At these communities' age, we are experiencing a movement away from congregate meal settings to more home-delivered meals. This significantly increases costs because it's much more difficult with rising transportation costs to get to the food to very isolated areas, and it also is tough to manage the cost due to rising raw food costs, which impact our services. Also, the nutrition program relies on many volunteers to prepare, deliver, and maintain the program in many communities. But with the aging we're seeing in many of the communities, it is becoming more difficult to recruit and maintain a strong, vibrant base of volunteers because many of them are in their 80s and 90s, and we just don't see a wealth of young people that are there stepping in to take their place once they're no longer able to volunteer. I can name many small communities where we provide meals that have populations under 300, such as Lake Lillian and other places. I can share a story from Cross Lake that we received a note from a person named Bud, and his wife wrote to us saying that she truly believed the senior meals at Cross Lake in Minnesota at the community center saved her husband's life. She had been working many long hours and had to be away from home. Bud was 77 at the time, and he said he never felt hungry. He rarely ate, and if he did, it was only a little bit of a sandwich. One day, she took a good look at him and noticed that he was nothing more than a walking skeleton. He's 6 foot tall and weighed 142 pounds. She took him immediately to a senior meals program the next day in Cross Lake and signed him up. He has been going there for 5 years and 5 days a week. He now weighs 158 pounds, which is thin, but he's always been thin. Not only does he have good meals, he has made many friends with folks the same age. He looks forward to going every day, and once his wife retired, she started volunteering at the site. She says, thank goodness for the nutrition program. She doesn't know what she would have done without the availability of the service. Even with the challenges with providing nutritional services in rural Minnesota, there are opportunities for innovation and innovative solutions that LSS and other organizations that provide services can pursue. I believe we as providers should be encouraged and supported in developing greater innovation. Some of the methods we are pursuing include seeking partnerships with other nutrition providers across Minnesota to achieve enhanced buying power to hold down our raw food cost. Continue to look for opportunities for volunteers by engaging schools and other community partners and building intergenerational opportunities. Innovating new methods of service delivery to meet the needs of each community specifically. One of those ideas is a diner's club concept where we're able to partner with a local rural restaurant to provide our meals. This concept has been a win-win in communities as it has not only provided us a way to serve seniors in rural areas of Minnesota, but it has also been an economic development for the small business owners. It helps them keep their doors open year-round and able to reduce their food costs as well. There's frozen meal options that are available where people will have their meals delivered for a week, maybe by UPS or FedEx or a volunteer driver, but they'll be able to get meals bundled and have more options and choices. We need to focus funding on deep and creative engagement of older adults who are in the high-risk population. And we need to continue the engaged conversation with the Minnesota Board on Aging and our local area agencies on aging on how to transform nutrition services so that it can continue to have an impact on keeping older adults in their homes and in the communities as long as they desire. With the numbers of older Americans expected to grow significantly over the short term, senior nutrition represents one of the several critical areas where capacity needs to be developed over the short term to meet the need. And by doing so, we will save significant public dollars. When older adults have active socialization and an opportunity at nutrition, as we provide, they will age well and live longer in their homes. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks to both of you. And, the testimony this morning has been concerning, and this is of significant concern to me when I think about Bud and the story that you tell about someone really hungry in greater Minnesota and rural Minnesota. And when I think about people aging in Minnesota and living in small communities across the state, this is an issue. And first and foremost, I want to thank you for your continued efforts and push to try and find new ways to try and solve this problem. And that is, of course, one of the virtues of Minnesota and Minnesotans. But as I was looking at Ms. Wood's PowerPoint presentation, and I'm looking at the impact of 2013, talking about tapping reserves and making short-term adjustments, I think that is, tools that we have been using in Minnesota, and sometimes to good effect for short-term solutions, but also, I think, unfortunately, in efforts to balance the budgets during a decade of political fighting over taxes, right? Set that aside. I was in Mora last week, Senator Lori, visiting with some school superintendents, and they were talking about how for the Mora High School, as a result of the budget that was balanced in 2011, they had to go to the bank to borrow $500,000 to make payroll for their school, just to make the payroll. The impasse that we saw in Minnesota led to some situations in Minnesota that weren't in our interest or the future of our kids' interest. And this presentation that you're giving me brings that to mind. And the sequestration, again, I think is evidence of political gridlock and not decision making. And gratefully in Minnesota, we've found our way around that and we're making some progress. But this, especially senior nutrition, I think is something we need to pay close attention to. All of what we've heard today from the testifiers is of concern, but I don't want people hungry in Minnesota if we can avoid that. And if the Congress isn't able to attend to this, we're going to have people in Minnesota who are going to need some attention. I hope that they get their act together. But I would like you to continue to brief us and inform us on the progress that you're making as well. Thank you.
Any other questions? Can we get a copy of your remarks?
Yes.
Okay. You can talk to Kate. She can. Well, you probably have, I suppose. Well, thank you for. Do you know what the total unmet need is on nutrition? I mean, so you already are getting dollars, but I assume that there's people beyond the people you're even without sequestration.
Currently, we have not had, and historically, we have not had much of a waiting list. I think we can look into the future. There may be waiting lists at some point. This is not the first time we have faced cuts, not the first time we've had to look at economizing and setting up priorities around what services the area agency should fund. So, it has been a gradual change that we've been able to put through these systems, quite frankly, much due to the talents of our contracted providers like Lutheran Social Service. And so at this point, we don't have waiting lists of people. We do have unserved communities and have historically.
Right.
And as he made reference to, there may be more smaller communities that go unserved.
All right. Thank you. So, Ms. Bergman and Mr. Ball. Am I missing someone? Welcome.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Rick Ball. I'm the Executive Director of the Housing and Redevelopment Authority of Duluth, and I greatly appreciate the opportunity to address you this morning and appreciate the your concern over the impact of sequestration on the people that we serve. I'd like to share with you some of the housing-related issues that we're experiencing in Duluth, which I think would be fairly typical of what housing authorities are experiencing both around the state and across the country as a result of the impact of sequestration. And then following that, Jennifer Bergman, the executive director of the Brainerd Housing Redevelopment Authority, and the president of Minnesota NARO, the Association of Housing Redevelopment Officials, will cover the statewide impact as well. With regard to the Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher Rent Subsidy Program, which provides vouchers for income-qualified households and subsidizes their rent so that they pay 30 to 40% of their income, and the voucher covers the remainder of a fair market monthly rent payment. The Duluth HRA has had to reduce the number of vouchers that we issue for the first time in our agency history. And we've also had to reduce our program staffing at a time when we're experiencing a growing waiting list, and the need has really never been greater. In Duluth, we normally administer 1,472 vouchers. That's the amount that we're funded for through the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. But because of the budget authority, as a result of sequestration, it's forced us to reduce the program by 30 vouchers immediately, which we're currently accomplishing through attrition. We're not issuing new vouchers as vouchers are given up. And our waiting list is often at about 1,000, which is certainly too large to begin with, but it represents about a 1 year to 16-month wait for a Section 8 voucher. It's now grown to about 1,800 households, growing quickly toward 2,000 households, which will represent about a 2 year wait for a household that comes in to apply for a voucher today. This also will depend a little bit on what I refer to as residual impact. Unfortunately, what we're experiencing is that there's a very significant downward spiraling in the formula for the Section 8 funding program. Next year's formula allocation will be based on this year's funding and the performance that a housing authority experiences with voucher utilization. So if we're really only given a level of funding that allows us to utilize 98% of the vouchers that we're authorized to issue, then next year's funding will be based on this year. So there will be a decreasing funding level next year that will further drop the amount of vouchers and the amount of households that we're able to serve. We currently have an average housing assistance payment of about $400 per voucher, and so we see a need to further reduce that based on next year's funding. It's really a compounding problem. It's kind of a catch-22. We have also are in the process of fully exhausting our reserves. We're nearly down to zero in the way of reserves. So that also is impacting kind of our business model. We've typically wanted to have at least a month or so worth of reserves, and really that's becoming fully exhausted. We're projecting at this point that by the end of 2014, we may need to cut an additional 100 to 125 vouchers. And again, that downward spiral will continue at a time while the need is growing. The Section 8 program brings to Duluth about $6.6 million annually in direct funding, so that impacts our local economy. It allows private landlords to rent their units at fair market rent levels. Through sequestration, the reduction of about 6.3% of funding has caused a loss of $428,000 in that allocation. The indirect loss is estimated to be about six times that amount, that as those federal dollars come into the economy, they start rolling through about six times through the economy. So already the direct impact is over $2.5 million. The human impact on the households, the people that we serve, is that we'll start to see more overcrowding. We're already starting to see more overcrowding, doubling up with family and friends. We're seeing people living in substandard housing, and we're seeing people increasingly paying more than 50% of their income for rent. That puts more of a strain on the households that we serve to spend, as they spend more on rent, they have less to spend for clothing and food and other needs. We feel as though the stable housing is really a foundation for a good life, including a solid education and other aspects. With regard to state funding, this puts more pressure and increased need for our Bridges program. As you may know, the Bridges program is funded through Minnesota Housing. It provides funding for people with mental health issues as they apply for the Section 8 assistance. We bridge the time period that they need a housing subsidy and cover that cost as a rent subsidy voucher with the Bridges funding. We have typically seen that program fund clients for a period of about 6 to 8 months. We expect that that's now going to grow to up to 2 years worth of time. And again, as we're serving fewer people, there will be more of a backlog of need that will continue to grow. And so we may see a kind of a multiplication of up to about five times the need as that program kind of slows down and becomes bottlenecked. So the needs of that special population are growing. There are a few other related concerns that I just want to mention. This certainly puts more pressure and an increased need for our local tax levy to fund administrative shortfalls as we struggle with the administration of these programs. With regard to capital fund, we're also currently seeing 2012 was really the lowest funding that we received from the Department of Housing and Urban Development in over a decade. We have a growing backlog of capital improvement needs to maintain the investment in the public housing stock. Duluth has, for instance, about 1,150 units of public housing, including six high-rises. We have a capital fund budget now of $1.3 million, which is down from over $2.6 million about 8 years ago. So we have a backlog of needs that include lead abatement, elevator improvements, important life safety issues. We have aging boilers and are looking to try to make energy improvements as we make those improvements, but we're struggling with the inability to do that. State funding from GO bond has been very helpful in with some of the critical improvements across the state. It's a competitive funding process, and that has helped with meeting some of the needs of some of the most critical needs of public housing authorities across the state. It's an ongoing need that we expect to continue as we face further cuts in federal funding. And this has been exacerbated by sequestration. So this need will continue, and we hope that the legislature will continue to provide some additional funding for that in the upcoming session. With regard to affordable housing development, the HUD supportive housing program has been cut significantly due to sequestration. It's derailed a process that is was designed to allocate funds for supportive housing. In Duluth, we had we have a program that we're trying to put together, the Steve O'Neill Hillside Apartments development, which represents 44 new units of supportive housing, as well as six new units of badly needed shelter. We were expecting an allocation of about $250,000, saw that as a very strong project that was very likely to be funded. Rather than being funded in November, the awards were delayed until July, and we've just recently learned that this project is not being funded. So it puts a $250,000 gap in providing for this new, really 50 units of badly needed affordable housing development. So we hope that we'll be able to find a solution to that, but it's threatening the success of that project. Also, I just want to mention that with regard to services, many nonprofits in the community that work with us, as well as the county to provide supportive services, are also being challenged by sequestration. And as we see a loss of services, that impacts the clients that we serve as well. So, again, I think the impact in Duluth is fairly typical of other agencies around the state and nation. Jennifer Bergman, our president of our State Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials, can address some of the statewide impact.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jennifer Bergman. I'm the Executive Director of the Brainerd Housing and Redevelopment Authority, as well as the Crow Wing County Housing and Redevelopment Authority. As Rick mentioned, I'm also the current president of Minnesota NARO, which is the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials. As I listened to the testimony today, I'm actually kind of glad we went last. It was really interesting hearing the other testimony. I realized that we house so many of these people. We house our elderly. We house the kids that are going to Head Start. We house veterans, and we house Native Americans. Sequestration and the budget cuts have had a significant impact on public housing and Section 8 throughout the state. I'd like to start by giving you a little picture of Brainerd. You'll probably hear a lot of the things that you heard from Rick, but I think it's okay maybe to hear it twice and hear the impacts both from a larger agency and a smaller agency as ours. The Brainerd HRA has 203 public housing units. The average household income of our residents is $12,409 annually. Our average tenant rent is $224 a month. The reason we're able to charge the tenants such a low rent is because, in theory, HUD will make up the difference in what they call an operating subsidy. There is a handout that was provided to you, the one that on the top has the Brainerd HRA. You'll see that the operating subsidy over the last 10 years has decreased. We're now at a level that we were back in 2006. Although the cost for us to operate our housing continues to increase. We also receive capital fund dollars from HUD. Operating subsidy is that what's used to help us bridge that gap. Capital funds are what's used to help us improve or maintain our properties. And if you look at page 2 of that handout, you'll see that our capital fund dollars now are lower than they were back in 2003. Again, as our costs to improve and maintain our properties continue to increase. Our housing choice voucher program, I'm going to say just a little bit more about capital fund before I go on to housing choice voucher. The other thing that happened to HRAs throughout the nation is recapturing of funds. The federal government recaptured about $850 million from our agencies. And a lot of that came from our capital fund dollars. There are a lot of small HRAs across the state that maybe only get $20,000, $30,000 a year in capital fund dollars. So they would save their capital funds to be able to do larger projects. HUD didn't recognize that that was a savings. They just saw that they had a large pool of funds, and those funds were recaptured. So a lot of our smaller HRAs really are facing some big issues where capital improvements are concerned. Our Housing Choice Voucher Program, which is also known as the Section 8 program, provides a voucher to an eligible family.
Can I just stop right on that one? So what are you, as you look forward on these subsidies and the capital fund, and what does that mean in terms of your operation? So what aren't you doing, you know, because you don't have those capital funds?
I can tell you what, specifically with the Brainerd HRA, we know that going forward, we're probably not going to, we're going to try to stretch our carpet as long as we possibly can. We are not going to repaint units. We're going to do the minimum that we need to get by as we see where the federal government goes with capital funds.
And what about on the operating side?
Operating subsidy right now in 2013, we received 85% of what we were eligible for. We have, the Brainerd HRA has been fortunate in that we have diversified a bit. We do have a levy, and we are using our levy dollars to help supplement the reduction that we see in our operating subsidy. So we're kind of shifting some staff allocations and putting more of the burden on our local community.
So you have a property tax levy authority.
We do.
Okay.
Yep.
And you're filling the gap with property taxes that you're losing from the...
That's okay. Part of how we're filling that gap.
Okay.
We've also done smaller things, closed our offices on Fridays to try to save, you know, whatever we can, lengthened our hours, you know, reduce our heating bill costs. We're doing whatever we can. We've been fortunate, well, I shouldn't say that, we've reduced our staff by 4 since 2010, so we're hoping we can maintain where we're at right now.
Oh, Tom. Senator Box.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Bergman, the levy authority, I know we have a small levy that's allowed. Is it at the county HRA level, the city HRA level, or are both of those authorities have levy authority?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Bergman.
Senator Box, both have levy authorities. The statute says 0.0185% of last year's taxable market value. Our Housing Choice Voucher Program, one of the things, and I think Rick alluded to this as well, that the voucher program not only provides a subsidy for a tenant, but it also provides rent for landlords. We get about $1.3 million annually in HAP funds that go right into the community, go right into the landlord. The Brainerd HRA has about 320 vouchers. Our average family income is $13,863. We have about 500 people on our waiting list right now. Our waiting list is currently closed because we have more, almost twice the number of people on our waiting list than we have vouchers available. We receive administrative fees to run our program. Again, I'll refer you to that document that I provided you on page 3. We are, the amount of funds that we are getting for admin fees is less now than it was in 2013. That's alarming, and again, we can kind of try to move our staff around, but I think what's more alarming is our HAP funds. We received 94% of our eligibility for HAP funds. HAP is housing assistance payments, and that's the money that goes to pay the rent for the Section 8 tenant. They pay 30% of their gross adjusted income towards their rent, and we pay the difference. The chart in your pack, and I understand it is not color, but the green line, one of the lines, shows the amount of HAP or the rent that we have paid to landlords, and the red line shows the amount of funds that we've received from HUD. As you can see, in 2013, they're going the wrong way.
So you're obligated to pay the landlord under your contract that you have with them?
Yes, we are. And as Rick mentioned, we're kind of taking people off through attrition. The other really difficult thing in managing our programs is we didn't find out what our budget was until July.
Right.
So we already have people on the program from January until July, and then we found out in July how much we're receiving for 2013. So now all of a sudden we're scrambling at the end of the year to try to make our ends meet.
So but to close that gap, then you'll just not put anybody in, and you'll just not issue a new voucher, which will grow the waiting list.
Correct. Okay. And as Rick mentioned, we're depleting all of our reserves. By the end of 2013, we will have no reserves.
Okay.
This will ultimately reduce our vouchers from 320 down to 305, so we're losing about 5% of our program, 15 vouchers. As Rick also mentioned, we're concerned about this being a permanent reduction. HUD bases our budget on our utilization. So if we have to reduce the number of vouchers that we're issuing because we're not receiving enough housing assistance payment dollars, next year that's what they'll look at. So we may have a permanent reduction of our vouchers going forward, which is why we're trying to deplete our reserves and do whatever we can to keep our utilization as high as we possibly can. That's Brainerd. I do want to talk a little bit about the statewide perspective on behalf of Minnesota NARO. The Minnesota Housing Partnership and Minnesota NARO administered an online survey to 144 PHAs or HRAs across the state to assess the impact of the federal budget cuts and sequestration on their programs. In Minnesota, 85% of agencies who responded have or expect to reduce the number of Section 8 vouchers due to the federal cuts. Over 72% of the respondents have waiting lists of 1 year or more, and 44% have a waiting list of over 2 years. Throughout the country, many agencies have just turned their voucher programs back. They just can't afford to administer the program anymore. The reduction in our administrative fees, which in 2013 we received 69% of what we're eligible for, or a reduction of 31%, we expect, or what we're hearing right now, is that'll probably be 67% prorated in 2014. it just makes it really impossible for us to run our programs. Public housing agencies across Minnesota are using all kinds of strategies to try to reduce their budget or address the federal budget cuts. We're depleting our reserves. We're deferring capital improvements, as I mentioned earlier, and ongoing maintenance items. We're increasing our waiting lists. We're imposing additional fees on our tenants, maybe parking fees, other things that we can do to make up that difference. We've reduced services for our seniors. I know at the Brainerd HRA, Good Neighbor provided services for our senior residents. We also had some Meals on Wheels as a result of budget cuts. Those programs have now been lost. And our capital fund reduction. I think we are so incredibly grateful to the legislature for providing GO bonds, $5.5 million last year in GO bonds, for us to be able to make some capital improvements to our project or to our public housing units. Nationwide, there's an estimated $3.4 billion in capital improvement needs in public housing, and right now only about $1.78 billion was appropriated nationwide for HRAs and PHAs across the state. And then maybe just to end on the state, in recognition of the importance of affordable housing to the stability and the health of Minnesota families, the 2013 session included funding increases for many of our housing programs, specifically $22 million investment in base funding for Minnesota housing. The 2013 also strengthened many tools used by HRAs to help preserve our affordable housing. And then the legislature approved over $30 million in housing infrastructure bonds. And then, as I mentioned, the $5.5 million in GO bonds that has really helped us to do some capital improvements in our public housing. So with that, Rick and I would like to thank you for having us here and to hearing about the struggles that we're facing with sequestration and federal budget cuts, and we'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Any questions? I think we've been exhausted. thank you very much for coming down. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
And we just didn't have one more item of business, which shouldn't take very long. And that's one of the charges we have from the last legislative session, which is to review advisory groups. And we really have two official things we have to do and then probably some other work we can do. So in your packets is the list that we've compiled of all the executive branch advisory groups. And what we're charged to do is first figure out what the list of all of them are. I think we've made good progress on identifying these. And one thing I'd just like to do to fulfill our statutory obligation is just adopt this list for now, and it can be amended later on as we move through this. But then the next pieces of it, and I will say that in addition to this document, we've gotten a stack of documents from the agencies. We did a request providing more detail on all of these, when they were founded, what their budgets are, whether they've issued reports, when they've met, to give us a kind of a start down the path of looking at these. And we'll get that distributed, you know, as it's compiled. We have a few agencies that have yet to respond, but most have responded with good information. So the second charge is to set up a schedule of reviewing some of these executive advisory groups, whether they're needed any longer. In fact, some of the agencies have identified some that haven't met and we can delete from statute already. There may be some others that we're going to want to look at and see whether they're fulfilling their mission or can be combined or what have you. That'll be the next step. And, you know, one thought I had is we don't need this whole group necessarily to do some of that work. If we could get a smaller group who volunteer or are interested in kind of going through some of those documents, we may want to have some public hearings on some of the groups to see if they're, you know, where they are in their mission, whether they're fulfilling their mission, or whether they can, you know, be changed or what have you. So we'll get an email out on that to identify that. But what I'd just like to do today is just adopt this list for now as the list that we're going to start working off of, and then we'll sit down and work together to figure out a schedule of review. And many of these agencies, I don't think we need to review. For instance, you know, the State Board of Investment has an advisory group of investment advisors from across the state that help them make decisions about their investments. It doesn't seem to me that's one we really want to eliminate, right? Hopefully people would think that. I don't know. There are others, I think, that we could take a closer look at. So, thank you. Senator Bach just moved adoption of this list. Any discussion? Yes.
Just a question, Mr. Chairman. I have certainly no objection to, you know, adopting what you want to adopt today. But as to the second portion of the issue, would you be receptive to putting that on the agenda for the next time so we could talk about it a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. We just kind of are running out of time here.
Yeah,
I would like to talk about it more.
Sure.
It's something that so my goal is by, you know, December or January, we've kind of put these into buckets of things we probably don't need to look at because we have a consensus that there are things that ought to continue. Some that we are clear we want to, you know, can be eliminated because they haven't met in, you know, 3, 5, 10 years.
Sure.
And then this middle group where we're going to want to look and see, is this serving its purpose and do we want to continue with it? And then set up a schedule for reviewing those. So that's the ultimate kind of goal here. So, yes, this is just the beginning.
Very good. Thank you.
Yes. All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? That is adopted. And I guess we can then adjourn.
Mr. Chair, could I?
Yes.
And something I don't think we need to talk about today. I'd just like to maybe make a special request of you, and you can take it under whatever matter of advisement you want. Looking at the title of this Planning and Fiscal Policy Commission, I would like to see us at some point in advance of the sale of stadium bonds just kind of look to where we are relative to the funding pathway on those. And just to make sure from the standpoint of the legislative bodies that we're on a pathway that we can generally feel comfortable with. And I would just ask if you could consider that as possible future agenda item going forward.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and we can, there's the legislative, we do have a legislative advisory committee for the
right.
For the stadium, but we can certainly take a look at that. It would be,
and I don't mean it to be political or anything else. I think it's just important.
No, do we understand it? I don't disagree.
Yeah.
Senator Bach.
Senator Sundrum's point, I would like to know whether the provision we put in law to reprice the stocked cigarettes in warehouses or on retailers' shelves, if that really brought in what the estimate had anticipated, which was...
Yeah. I think it brought in more.
Around 24 million. I haven't seen the number.
We just found out. I think it was 33 million yesterday, I think.
Oh.
Is that right, Ann?
I think it's 30.
30-some million.
I didn't see
it. Mr. Namas.
Mr. Chair and Sundrum, I believe Mr. Marks and I are just double-checking with each other that we just received notification that it brought in $30
million. $30
million,
yeah.
Give or take.
So. All right.
Good. Thank you very much.